Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up this hour from the Republican convention. We have President Bush's former UN ambassador, a kind of neocon icon, and that's John Bolton. We'll see if he thinks Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan are that kind of Republican when it comes to foreign policy. Might have Herman Cain in about 15 minutes, so stand by for that. Right now, ABC News White House correspondent Jake Tapper joins us. Hi, Jake. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian, how are you?
Okay, I see you did not draw the Tampa card, so your job is to follow the president around this week instead?
That's right. I'll be with President Obama, and then we'll go into Charlotte next week for that convention. So, the White House, the original plan, of course, was for Vice President Biden himself to be down in Tampa, responding in real time to things being said about the president from the Republican podium. That, of course, was scotched because of Tropical Storm Isaac. But
Because of Tropical Storm Isaac, or was it because of loose-lipped Joe and y'all back in chains and all of that?
Well, I wasn't privy to the actual decision, but, the announcement that he was going down to Tampa came after the kerfuffle, after the y'all back in chains. So I can only assume that it really did have to do with the concern that a vice president going down to Tampa while a tropical storm was bearing down on the city and the area would deplete the city of resources focused on the vice president's safety as opposed to the city's. But who knows?
And, of course, they'll have a lot to respond to no matter where they are. For example, here is RNC Chairman Reince Priebus on CNN yesterday on the mission of this convention.
I think it's incumbent on us to do two things. One, we still have to prosecute the president as far as whether he fulfilled the mission that he laid out in 08. And he didn't. But the second piece is telling the story about a man that's decent, honorable, gave away his father's inheritance, started something from nothing and created a great business, five good boys, saved the Olympics, governed in a difficult state as a Republican, and he was very successful. We need someone to fix this economy, and Mitt Romney is the one that can do it.
And, Jake, that's interesting language from the RNC chairman, prosecute the president. And he said it twice in a short stretch there in that CNN interview. He said it again this morning in Tampa. So they're using that word. Does that imply that not only do people ask for his birth certificate, but the president is somehow criminal in his behavior?
No, I don't think so. There's a lot of metaphors and language that people in politics use. Usually it's warlike language that they're talking about, attacks and salvos and flack. I think they just mean that they need to present a case to the American people. I assume that's what they mean anyway, that they need to present a case to the American people. Because, quite frankly, there are a lot of Republicans who thought that by now, because of the unemployment rate, because of the stagnating economy, Mitt Romney would be ahead in the polls, that he would be doing better than he's doing right now. And the fact is that they have not been able to pass this. Essentially, Obama and Romney are deadlocked, with maybe Obama has a slight edge, especially in the battleground states, but he's not been able to break through Mitt Romney, and so they feel like they need to make the case even stronger than just the economy's not working, Obama, his programs have failed, therefore we need to change teams. They have found that through focus groups and polling that there still is a reservoir of goodwill for the president, even among independent voters who are skeptical that he'll be able to do much more, President Obama. The people still believe that he has their interests at heart, that he is empathetic to them. And so they need to put on a stronger case, quite frankly, the Republicans.
So here is part of the case for the prosecution, combined with a message of Republican optimism. Listen to Reince Priebus' language here about Obama.
So we're the party that embraces success. And I got to tell you, I think that this sort of miserable, glass-half-full America that Barack Obama is selling out there is not the America that parents want for their kids. And I think we can take that message of the American dream and embracing success, and we can win on that message.
RNC Chairman Reince Priebus again on CNN yesterday. The miserable, glass-half-full America that Barack Obama is selling. Now, I think he meant glass half empty.
Yeah, I think
but,
so. Right.
But why does he put it in those terms? Aren't both candidates selling the idea that their vision is more optimistic?
Right. People want to feel better. Voters want to feel better. Right now, a majority of the public feels that the country's on the wrong track. A majority are fearful that their kids will not have a better life than they did, than they're having. And so right now, optimism is an important commodity. People want to feel good. Voters want to feel good. They know that there are problems with this country, but they want to feel like the best days still can be ahead of them. And this is a problem for both Obama and Romney. For Romney, you want to make the case to the American people that things can be much better, but you don't want to bash the current situation so much that people don't feel positively about you. The president has the flip argument. He wants to sell the fact that things are improving. But his focus groups and his polls have indicated that a lot of individuals have been turned off by President Obama talking about things getting better because they don't believe it. They don't see it in the results. So even if you and I know, if you look at numbers, that you know there has been improvement in the nation's economy and such, the people don't feel like it in their day-to-day lives, in their paychecks. And so they both have this negotiation to do, Romney and Obama, of things can get better, and but we are still America, and our best days are ahead of us. But then they're both walking a tightrope.
ABC News White House correspondent Jake Tapper with us. And we can take some phone calls. Listeners, maybe you want to weigh in from whatever your partisan perspective is. Which party is more optimistic than the other, since Reince Priebus seems to have put that in play? Or anything else, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Jack in Manchester, Vermont, wants to comment on the word prosecute. Jack, you're on the air. Hello.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen. I hope to see you, Brian, in RNC in Tampa, because you have a booth over there. Anyway, my problem is this with the Republican Party, mostly led by white men. When Romney talks, do you ever see any people of color over there? No. So this is pure hatred for a black man who's the president. They just can't see it. I wish he fails. Mitch McConnell says we'll make sure he fails. And now to raise the Bertha issue when everything was dead in the water, and, you know, this guy at CNBC,
Kudlow?
Man, the anchor, he had a good debate in today's morning show.
Jack, I'm gonna leave it there. Well, the issue keeps coming up of racial appeal. And, you know, we had a conversation with Molly Ball from The Atlantic last hour, Jake, about the birther joke that Mitt Romney made on Friday and whether that was really just a one-off stumble or whether it connects to the theme of the convention for Thursday night, when Romney, of course, is scheduled to speak. And the official theme of the convention for Thursday night is "We believe in America," which implies they don't believe in America, which implies that President Obama is somehow un-American or less than fully American. The whole birther joke implies that somebody needed to ask to confirm his birth certificate. So there's what Molly called this hazy foreignness that they try to keep enveloping around Obama, which is kind of a racial code in one way or another. Are you seeing it at the convention? Is it something you're watching for at the convention?
Well, I haven't seen it at the convention, and, you know, the convention hasn't started. Look, there is a lot of sensitivity about this issue. A lot of supporters of the president's feel as though the whole birther issue is rooted in racism and xenophobia. And I certainly understand that. I don't disagree that a lot of it is. That said, I think that not every single criticism of President Obama's, and certainly no one is saying this, is racist or xenophobic. Let me just give you one example. Democrats used to say during the Bush years, Democrats talked about taking back America, this not being the America that they were used to. Republicans saying the same thing are charged quite often with the notion that this is somehow based in race. I think that the charge of racism or the charge of appealing to people with racism tinged attack, such as the birther attack. These are things that have to be, when they're thrown out, these accusations haphazardly, they have the effect of diminishing when actual racism or actual racist code is being used. And that's regrettable. Because, look, the birther attacks are, to a large degree, rooted in racist and xenophobic views of President Obama. Even more than that, they're rooted in nonsense. I mean, the guy was born in Hawaii, and there's proof to it, and the fact that we're still talking about it in the fourth year of his presidency is unbelievable to me.
So in pure, hardcore political calculation terms, are they making a guess that even now, even after this has been, you know, worked for 4 years plus, and it's really the hardcore of the Republican base, you would think, that is the most susceptible to it, do they still think that there's something to be gained in the 2012 election by returning to at least implying the otherness of Barack Obama?
Well, the question is whether or not Mitt Romney made that as an off-the-cuff joke, and he didn't really mean anything by it, and it was just a quip, and you have to have a sense of humor in politics.
And when John Sununu did it, and when it's We Believe in America, and, you know, all those things that could be taken as one of the messages that they're putting out there.
Mm-hmm. In
political strategic terms.
There is definitely an otherizing that goes on of President Obama by his opponents. It happened in 2008. It happened, you know, since then, and it will happen this year. It definitely happens. And I think that the question is whether or not when Mitt Romney made the birther joke, you know, was he consciously trying to feed into that? Or was he just trying to make a lighthearted joke? And it really just depends on who you believe.
Let's get back to Romney and his image problems. George Will on the ABC This Week Roundtable yesterday put it succinctly. He said, Romney may not feel your pain, but he can fix your pain. We'll hear that Mr. Fix-It theme a lot this week.
I think that's right. I don't think that the Romney team feels that they can beat Obama on likability or empathy. And far more important than likability is empathy. And he consistently, the president, pulls ahead of Mitt Romney when it comes to who has your interests at heart. And so they are counting on the idea that they will be able to sell Romney and Ryan as an adult team that will take on the country's problems and fix them. You know, remember, Brian, this is going to come down to maybe a million voters. This is not targeted at, you know, all however many, 150 million people that go to the polls.
Right.
This is really about just a very small group of independent, persuadable, and women voters, in addition to rallying the bases of the respective parties, of course.
Well, it's and that's the balance. How much rallying, how much appealing to kind of centrist independent swing voters. The Wall Street Journal had a piece that was a pro-Romney opinion piece the other day that said that a lot of independents are sufficiently turned off to Obama that the Republican campaign will or should appeal to those independents because they have more to gain that way. The Democrats have more to gain by appealing to their base and throwing red meat to their base. Do you agree with that analysis, and is that what you expect to see this week in Tampa, a concerted effort to win over swing voters rather than appeal to the base?
It depends on what speeches you're talking about. I think that the speeches you're going to hear from the people who will be airing in prime time, aired on the networks, whether Chris Christie or Bill Clinton, will be targeted very much at persuadable independent voters. But let's say take a hypothetical businesswoman in Northern Virginia, ambivalent about President Obama, disappointed in him, not sold on Mitt Romney. That's who Chris Christie In his keynote address for the Republican convention, and Bill Clinton in his keynote address for the Democrat, not keynote address, his introductory address, he'll be introducing President Obama for President Obama at the Democratic convention, will be about. They'll be aimed at those people. Or Mayor Castro, I guess, from San Antonio is giving the keynote for the Democrats. Yeah.
Dan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I mean, what use is the convention process to this whole campaign? I'm just dumbfounded, and I don't want to sound like a snob, believe me, because I'm not an intellectual giant, but I am just dumbfounded how stupid the electorate is in thinking that a particular candidate is going to make them feel good and is going to solve the problems facing this country. I mean, if people think that Romney is going to turn around the economy in 3 or 4 years, they've got another thing coming to them. You know, it took close to 20 years for the economy to recover from the Great Depression, if you measure it by the Dow Jones average. So, I mean, what are people thinking? I mean, what do they think they get out of these conventions?
I think the conventions are, first of all, an opportunity for people who are part of the Republican and or Democratic parties to regroup, to feel good, to get their message, and to go out. It's kind of like a pep rally before the game. That's why they're held right before Labor Day, when the election really, really kicks off. It's an opportunity for people to feel good about their candidate, to get their message, to get their talking points, and to run out. So that's one. Two, it is an opportunity for people, for voters who have not been paying attention as intensely as perhaps the average Brian Lehrer listener, to hear what the parties have to say. Again, remember, this comes down to 1 or 2 million voters who haven't necessarily been paying the closest attention, and they want to know, well, what does Mitt Romney want to do? What is his program? Or President Obama, okay, he didn't achieve everything he said he wanted to achieve. The economy's still not doing well. What's his explanation? What would he want to do for a second term? And it is an opportunity for the parties to make their case. And I realize that they get criticized as stage-managed and silly and worthless, but ultimately I do think that they are that they have worth for people who want to actually just like tune in and see what side they want to get on before November.
And they have worth to somebody, because if they say 30 million people are going to be watching Chris Christie's speech tomorrow and maybe 50 million people are going to be watching Mitt Romney's speech on Thursday night, as you know, Jake, those are rare numbers for television networks these days. And so somebody wants to know, and somebody thinks there's something to be learned there. And I think you're right. They're not the people who listen to the Brian Lehrer Show every day. They're not only the people who do. They're not the people who watch, you know, Nightline every night or ABC World News Tonight. And this week on Sunday mornings. And so that's why, from a political perspective at least, they're so important, even if
and
they're
have
not
worth.
Nominated.
I mean, this is a great opportunity for Mitt Romney and for Barack Obama to make their case. Think about the 1992 convention. Bill Clinton reintroduced himself to the American people in the 1992 Democratic convention. I think it was in New York City. He reintroduced himself. It had been a primary season full of scandals and ugliness, and, you know, Jennifer Flowers, and all of a sudden you have this film by the Thomasons, very effective, I Still Believe in a Place Called Hope. And you know, 20 years later, Brian, you and I, I'm sure, still remember that
right.
movie, how effective
That's
that
right.
movie was. Obama and Romney are both going to get their chances to have that kind of moment.
And by the way, folks, for us, it's kind of a festival of access. A lot of politicians and policymakers and thinkers who we may not have access to the rest of the year are wandering around Radio Row and ready to talk to us about policy. We think we have Herman Cain coming up in about 5 minutes. We do have John Bolton, the UN ambassador from the Bush administration, who's never come on the show before, coming up in about 15 minutes. So, Jake, before you go, we have 30 seconds. What should I ask Herman Cain? What is there left to ask Herman Cain? What would be interesting to ask Herman Cain? I stumped you.
That's an ambush question.
Okay, we're gonna we'll come up with something. If you think of something,
I'll email you, Brian.
Tweet me in the next 5 minutes if you come up with a great Herman Cain question. All right, ABC News White House correspondent Jake Tapper, who will be watching the president grimace this week and then covering the Democratic convention from Charlotte next week. Jake, we really appreciate it.
Thank you,
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We do have John Bolton coming up, maybe Herman Cain coming up. First, though, after this break, we'll talk more about the suburbs versus the MTA, why Westchester, Rockland, Nassau, and Suffolk all have this lawsuit going to end the payroll tax that gives the MTA 15% of its revenue. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and with us now from the Republican convention is President Bush's former U.N. Ambassador John Bolton, known as one of the biggest hawks and so-called neoconservatives in the Iraq War era. He's with the American Enterprise Institute these days, commentator on Fox News, where you may see him regularly, and he writes regular op-eds for the Wall Street Journal. Ambassador Bolton, we appreciate you giving us a few minutes. Welcome to WNYC.
No, glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
There are camps in Republican foreign policy circles, I don't have to tell you. Neocon versus realist, if you want to use the usual labels. Where do you see Mitt Romney?
Well, I don't like the labels. I don't like bumper sticker foreign policy, and I don't think they're very accurate, including when you called me a neoconservative, which is not accurate. So I think rather than engage in the bumper sticker style, we ought to look at the overall policy. And I do think that that Romney represents a very, very dramatic difference from the Obama approach to America's position in the world. I think he recognizes that you can't have sustained domestic prosperity without a strong American presence in the world. And the reverse is true as well. You can't keep a strong American posture internationally unless the economy is working.
Paul Ryan doesn't have much foreign policy experience, but I've seen him described as a student of John Bolton. Have you worked with Congressman Ryan much?
Sure, I know him well. He attends a lot of events at the American Enterprise Institute, and I've had a chance to talk to him over the years. So I haven't seen him described as a student of mine, but it would be an honor if somebody did.
It sounded like in your first answer that you wanted to bring the foreign policy question back to prosperity at home. But are there certain foreign policy priorities that you would like to see a Romney Ryan president and vice president have?
Well, I think there needs to be a reversal of the decline in American influence in the world. And I think Governor Romney has already said in books and speeches during the campaign, in fact, he would like to return to a peace through strength approach to foreign policy, typical of the Reagan administration. I think President Obama, by contrast, is the first American president since Franklin Roosevelt who doesn't wake up every morning and have as his first thought, what threats does the United States face today? I think he's inattentive, comfortable with American decline and withdrawal from our posture around the world. I think it harms us in a variety of ways, and I think the most graphic way is the cuts in the defense budget that we've seen during the Obama administration that leave us much less able to protect our interests around the world.
President Obama is perceived by many as stronger on foreign policy and even closer to Bush.
God knows why.
Well, even closer to, I'm not saying stronger than Romney, I'm saying closer to Bush-era policies than folks would have guessed. He stepped up the use of drones, most importantly, perhaps, kept Gitmo open despite his campaign in 2008, pivoted away from civilian trials for terrorism suspects, though he started down that road, defended indefinite detention without trial in court. Is there a big case to be made at this point that the parties are so different in the war on terror?
Oh, I think they're radically different. All of those cases that you've just mentioned have reflected 180-degree turns for Obama from his campaign. And I think what in 2008, and I think what that embodies is reality has intruded on his ideology. Let's just take Gitmo as an example. There was nothing more pronounced in the 2008 campaign than how bad Gitmo was. It was a recruiting tool for al-Qaeda. Remember that? And the president signed an executive order on January the 21st to close Gitmo in 1 year, and it's still open. Well, let me ask you this. Is Gitmo still a recruiting tool for al-Qaeda? And if it is, how come we're not worried about it anymore? This is the sort of sophistry in foreign policy that Obama expects the national media to ignore.
But what does that say about the actual level of difference in policy that you would get between an Obama and a Romney?
Well, I don't think these are the highest levels of policy. I think these are important things. I'm glad that the most left-wing president that we've ever had has validated what he criticized during the Bush administration, because it now means that these are tools that are available to all future presidents. But the real issue is America's overall approach to the world, to have a strategic view of how to deal with Russia, how to deal with China, how to deal with the threat of nuclear proliferation and the continuing war against international terrorism, even though the Obama administration doesn't want to talk about it.
Former UN Ambassador John Bolton, my guest on WNYC. What about Iran? Obama gave them a chance to come in from the cold early on in his administration, was criticized for wanting to open the door to dialogue, even by Hillary Clinton in the primaries in 08, and Iran did not respond positively. Now, many say Obama's been very tough on pushing sanctions, and he launched the Stuxnet virus against them on his watch. How do you assess Obama on Iran?
Well, I think he's been a real failure. I think Iran is now 3.5 years closer to getting nuclear weapons. The statistics that we have publicly available from the International Atomic Energy Agency show that Stuxnet did not reduce Iran's production of enriched uranium during the time it was in operation. And Iran gets ever closer to this 20-year-long objective of deliverable nuclear weapons. It simply played into Iran's hand to pretend that they were ever going to negotiate away their nuclear program. Time is not a neutral factor in diplomacy. Diplomacy is like any other human activity. It has costs as well as benefits. And in the case of a would-be nuclear proliferator, time is on their side. So giving them time for purported negotiation just allows them to get closer to their objective. And that's exactly what happened here.
What about the rap on Mitt Romney after his foreign trip recently, that he managed to alienate people in the UK, he managed to alienate people with not well-chosen remarks when he was in Israel, people were saying, well, gee, maybe this guy is actually not ready for prime time on the world stage.
Well, I notice you've left off Poland, the third stop on his trip, where he was all but endorsed for president by Lech Walesa, whom I at least consider a hero of the Cold War, a man who helped lead the fight for freedom in Poland. That is a huge achievement. Second, in Israel, the complaint was about a remark about conditions in the Palestinian territories that echoed, indeed, was almost a paraphrase of language in the 2002 United Nations Arab Human Development Report, which I've read and which the Arabs themselves recognize as a real problem. And as far as the thing about the Olympics in Britain, that was a tempest in a teapot.
With respect to what he said in Israel about culture having a lot to do with why the Israelis and the Palestinians are in different places, and not having even mentioned the occupation. Is that the stance that you want to take? Is that dismissing the Palestinians as a people who, I think, before the post-1967 era, Palestinians had a reputation as a relatively entrepreneurial Arab people?
Well, I don't think in his comments he dismissed the Palestinians as a people. I think that's a mischaracterization of what he said, and I think the culture point again is something that came almost verbatim from the Arab Human Development Report, and I don't think it's anything that really should be used against Governor Romney. I think what he was trying to do was praise Israel's entrepreneurial culture, and I wish we had more of an entrepreneurial culture today in the United States.
What do you think the U.S. should do about Syria?
Well, I think the circumstances in Syria now are, in effect, a proxy war between the Iranians on the one hand and the Sunni Arabs on the other. And I don't think the strategic environment is going to change, or the situation in Syria is going to change, until the strategic environment changes. And that means making Russia and China and Iran pull back their support from the Assad regime. A couple of months ago, Secretary of State Clinton said she was appalled that Russia had paid no price for its support of the Assad regime. Well, you know, Madam Secretary, you're in charge of the paying the price department. What steps did the Obama administration take to make Russia pay a price? Nothing. In fact, our policy for the past 18 months has been based on the complete misapprehension that Russia shared our objective to ease Assad out of power, when in fact Russia had no intention of seeing Assad leave power. He's been a reliable ally for Russia. They have their only naval base in the Mediterranean in Syria. They didn't want to see Assad leave power, and they've all but said so explicitly. They want him to stay in power. Yet that's what our policy was based on for 18 months. So it's no wonder our options are not very good at this point, when we were heading in such a misguided direction.
What could we do to Russia to put pressure on them that would make them flip on that?
I'd take the reset button and throw it away. I'd resume our missile defense, national missile defense efforts. I'd get out of the New START arms control treaty. I'd make it clear that as long as they fly political cover for the likes of Syria and Iran, that their relations with us are going to be in a very different place. I'd make the same point to China. As long as Putin thinks he can push and not get resistance by the United States, he will continue to push.
Last thing, we have Herman Cain coming on next in just a minute. Will this whole realm get a hearing in Tampa this week, or with the economy and the deficit, the issues this year? Is this just a conversation between policy wonks like us?
No, I think the American people understand full well that leadership is critical in a president. Foreign policy is a surrogate for leadership. I think they will see Governor Romney as a strong leader, and I think they can see very well after 3.5 years that President Obama is a weak leader.
John Bolton, former U.N. ambassador under President Bush, with the American Enterprise Institute, a commentator for Fox News, regular op-ed writer for The Wall Street Journal, and more. We really appreciate you giving us some time today. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be with you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, Herman Cain, and more of your calls coming up next. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with former presidential candidate Herman Cain from the Republican Convention. Mr. Cain, thank you very much for coming on WNYC today. Hello.
Happy to be with you. And I didn't know you had such cool music, or I would have been on your show before.
Yeah, well, we asked you when you were in the primaries. I guess you were a little busy. So the New York
Times... Just a little bit.
I've seen your event yesterday described, at least this is the New York Times description, you may want to take issue with it, as the alternate unity rally in a church made up mostly of Tea Party supporters. What exactly is your mission in Tampa, and what was yesterday, according to you?
My mission, along with the mission of a lot of others who participated in the unity rally, is to help inspire those that are non-delegates. The delegates are going to get a good dose of inspiration from a very impressive lineup of speakers during the convention, but there are a lot of people who are here in Tampa in the surrounding area that we wanted to come down and make a statement about unity, and I think we achieved that. And so the foot soldiers need some inspiration as well as the official delegates, and we are achieving that. Secondly, I've been doing a lot of media appearances, both radio and TV, to try and help convey to the people that can't be in Tampa the level of enthusiasm and excitement that I see that's building around this Romney-Ryan ticket. So that's why I'm here.
You talked last night about the ABCs, American Black
Yes.
Conservatives. There was
Yes.
one poll recently that showed Mitt Romney with 0% of the African-American vote. I'm sure it won't be zero. But
Right.
why do so few African-Americans believe that the Republican Party can be good for them? It's not just about having a black president who's a Democrat.
I believe that a lot of American Black conservatives, as I call them, ABCs, believe that the Republican Party, Mitt Romney and Ryan, would be good for them, because their main focus is not the color of somebody's skin. It's the economy and jobs. It's energy independence. It is getting our hands around spending. It's putting together budgets in order to be able to run the greatest country in the world. It's also not continuing to gut our military that's going to threaten our national security. And so, contrary to what some of the liberals believe, there are a lot of black people who can simply think for themselves, and they are looking at the critical issues that this nation faces.
But to many African Americans, the policies that the Republican Party in general stands for are anathema to African American interests, whether it be more funding for Pell Grants and other things to help people who are trying to pull themselves up by their bootstraps to get through college, or things for poor communities who are disproportionately African Americans, food stamps or whatever it might be, affirmative action, that the Republican Party on issue after issue after issue just does not line up with what the majority of African Americans see as their political interest in the United States.
That might be true for a majority of African Americans, but it is not true of all, because many of them are better educated than they were 40 years ago or 50 years ago. And I meet and I talk with a lot of closet conservatives all the time who happen to be black. And of those things that you mentioned, I think that the Republican Party gets a bad rap. See, the reason that the Republican Party gets a bad rap about those things is because they are sometimes discussed in isolation rather than part of a larger problem. Let me give you an example. The fact that President Obama gutted the work requirements out of welfare, are you going to tell me that that fits with the beliefs or the desires of a lot of black people in this country?
But
I can tell you from firsthand experience, it does not. I know a lot of black people that do not agree with gutting the work requirement out of the welfare
I'm surprised that you brought that up, because fact check organization after fact check organization has debunked that claim as inaccurate, that President Obama has certainly not gutted the workfare requirements out of welfare, nor even really given the states the flexibility to do that. And certainly no state has actually gutted those requirements, so there's no gutting that has taken place in the real world.
The president has stated his desire to allow the states the option to weaken those requirements. And so the terminology gutted, you're right. Technically, that has not happened. But quite frankly, Brian, you know, we can pick a whole lot of things that are not technically correct. But if President Obama has his way, they will be gutted by those states that want to weaken the work requirement.
In fact, many commentators have seen that as a racist appeal on the part of Romney to bring that up as an untruth. And again, the neutral fact-checking organizations, who, as you know, give it to both parties in both campaigns on a regular basis, have called that simply untrue. And critics have said that what Romney is really trying to do is tie the black president to the old black image of quote-unquote welfare queens and things like that, who are sponging off the taxpayers rather than being given the temporary help they need. You don't see it as racist?
I don't see it as racist at all. And there again, Brian, every time Governor Romney or a conservative or Republican criticizes President Obama about something that he wants to do or something that he proposes to do, and it impacts, you know, you don't just have black people that are on welfare. You got a lot of people that are on welfare of all colors and all ethnic backgrounds.
But you know how it looks to white America generally, right?
But to conjure up every criticism as being racially motivated or having a racial component is just how it just shows the desperation of the Democrats and the Obama administration in trying to get a positive message out there.
But they don't do that about everyone. They do that about selected ones where this issue seems to be implied.
They do it for selected ones whenever they think that they can get some people in the media to go along with this playing of the race card, as I call it. I mean, look, we could go down a whole list of example after example after example and have a debate as to whether or not there's a racial implication. And that is done frequently more so by the Democrats than it is done by the Republicans.
My guest on WNYC for a few more minutes is former presidential candidate Herman Cain from the Republican convention. You are still, I gather, promoting your 999 tax plan. I wonder if you would talk for a minute about the nine that was probably most controversial at the time, and that was the value-added tax or sales tax, which a lot of policy wonks think is actually a good idea, but to average Americans is seen just as a tax hike. What, they're going to put a federal 9% sales tax on the things I buy in addition to everything else? Can you talk about the philosophy behind that and what hope you think that might actually have in a Romney administration?
The narrative in this country needs to become replace the tax code. And there are three good options on the table that have been on the table. Two of them have been on the table for decades. The flat tax on income, the fair tax, which is a national sales tax, and I introduced the concept of 999. What 999 does is that it brings the flat tax believers, that's the first two nines, and the fair tax sales tax believers, that's the third nine, all to the table so we can begin to really solve the biggest problem, which is our insane tax code. The people who do not want to get rid of the tax code have criticized it as a tax hike, and they have criticized the third nine, which is a 9% sales tax, as being a tax hike. No, it is not. If people read the entire proposal, they will find that we have a poverty allowance in there such that people that are making the least amount of money are not unduly penalized for having to pay that. That doesn't get brought out when people criticize it as a tax hike. The other comment that I will make relative to that criticism is tax codes don't raise taxes. Politicians do. And so the people have to hold politicians' feet to the fire in order for them not to raise their taxes, even though we would now have three ways that they can manipulate it. The biggest problem with the current tax code, Brian, is that it is used to manipulate people. It is used to provide favors to certain crony groups that they want to do and things of this nature, and that's not the way the code was intended when it was started back in 1913, and that's why we need to throw it out and replace it with a much simpler, fairer structure.
Do you think that the Romney-Ryan tax plan, as they've laid it out, can actually be revenue neutral without raising taxes on the middle class? They're talking about a big cut in percentage terms, which would obviously go more to people at the top to start out. Then they're talking about ending or reducing some of the deductions, which would also, in percentage terms, hit wealthier people harder. But the way that Democrats and others have crunched the numbers, if you're going to give that much of a break to people at the top, you're going to have to increase the burden on people in the middle.
I absolutely believe that the cuts that Romney and Ryan are proposing will not only be revenue neutral, but I believe it will generate more revenue, and it's going to cause businesses to begin to grow again. The reason some of the number crunchers have concluded different from that is because they use a distorted set of assumptions. That was an article in the Wall Street Journal recently where the writer looked at what has happened when we have reduced tax rates over the last 40 or 50 years when it was done the right way. Revenues always went up. The fundamental flaw in some of these analyses is that they use what you call static analysis.
We just have 30
static
seconds.
Static analysis.
But there's
static analysis.
There's no projection, even by Ryan and his budget, that revenues would actually increase. There would still be a net cut in federal revenues from the plan. I'm sorry to say we only have 15 seconds, because they want to shrink government. You want to shrink government, don't you?
I want to shrink government also, and in 30 seconds, we are not going to be able to exhaust this discussion about how the numbers were crunched.
Right.
Brian, thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for doing it. Former presidential candidate Herman Cain, Brian Lehrer on WNYC.